Hey everybody, welcome to Stuff Said, the show where I, Greg Schiegel, a working cartoonist, talk to people in the world of comics, cartooning, and beyond. Today's show is probably best categorized under beyond, as my guest is the first guest I've spoken to in the world of comics journalism, the comics press, comics punditry, whatever term you might use for it. We get to the bottom of it in this episode. How we address it. Anyway, I'm talking to Heidi MacDonald, the proprietor, editor-in-chief of comicsbeat.com, more commonly known as The Beat. And Heidi is a really interesting person to talk to because, well, firstly, she is the most of or like a stranger guest I've had on the show. For the most part, when I've talked to people on the show, I've exchanged some sort of conversations with them. We know each other on some level. Heidi, I really didn't know. I'd seen her. She's a notable, known person. But we had never actually conversed. We exchanged a couple emails setting up the conversation, but that was it. When we sat down to talk, it was really the first time we had talked. But beyond that, while she really does, in a lot of ways, represent comics journalism, she's done a lot. She's had a long career in comics as a critic, writer, as a editorial presence at Disney Adventures Magazine and DC and Vertigo. She's done a lot of stuff, and it was interesting to talk to her about as much of that stuff as possible. I could have had the whole show just be about comics journalism, but, you know, as I was doing my research and looking into things, it felt like shortchanging. So the big talk about comics journalism and all that, I mean, we talk about it. Don't get me wrong. We talk for over an hour. It gets covered. But we talk about a lot of other stuff, and I think, regardless of what you might think of Heidi, and I only say that because she's a comics journalist pundit person, so she is out there and she's speaking to a lot of different things, and just based on the website alone and the comment sections, people have a lot of opinions. So that's all I'm addressing here. She was perfectly lovely. It was great to talk to her, and I feel like I learned quite a bit, and yeah, just an interesting talk across the board. So enough of me talking about the talk. Here's that talk with Heidi MacDonald. So I did some due diligence.
Okay.
I mean, you're somebody that's known. You're not some stranger off the street.
And a lot of it's on the internet.
But not all of it, though.
No.
Because there's a time before the internet.
It's hard to believe.
And some of that stuff, I'm going to admit, I could not find the Comics Journal articles. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I threw out my copies of Comic Buyer's Guide a long time ago.
You and everyone else.
So I can't
thank
really...
Thank God.
Yeah. I can't really find those pieces. But in a few interviews and things you've done, you mention two things that I thought were really interesting. One is that you're homeschooled. And two is that your mom was a cartoonist.
Right.
Or still is a cartoonist.
Yes. Well, yeah. Yeah, well, in a way, sort of, yeah.
What kind of cartoonist was your mom?
Well, my mom was a very talented artist, and like a lot of people in my family, there's a lot of artistic talent in my family. And she was primarily a painter, but around the time of the underground comics, she got interested in doing them. And so there was this thing called the Alternative Features Service, which was a kind of a AP for underground newspapers and stuff. And they created material, included articles, included comics. And I believe Trina Robbins was the editor there, actually, followed by Lee Mars. And my mother submitted some comics there, and they were accepted. And then she kind of did these things that were a lot longer, and they had, like, battles over, like, whether to accept them or not. So she had a very brief, you know, it's not like she had a huge volume. I mean, really, it was only a handful of comics. But it was something she did. And, I mean, she always drew. She always did stuff. And now she does, I mean, she had a fine arts career as well. Did illustrations. She wrote. She now does protest paintings, banners up in Maine. She lives up in Maine. And just last week, they were protesting at the state capitol for healthcare. And she's like very proud because her banners are being held up and everything. So.
And then was she your teacher?
No, my grandmother was my teacher. Her mother. Yeah.
Got it. So the art and the comics weren't part of the teaching. Like you weren't being
Well, my grandmother was also into comics. I mean, I had a very strange hippie family upbringing, okay. like a lot of people my age.
Was this up in Maine?
It wasn't in Maine. It was in New Jersey, okay. mostly. But, you know, my grandparents were bohemians. My mom wasn't really a hippie, but everybody else in the family was. So she was really the straight edge of the family, I suppose.
Has the edge gotten straighter with each generation now that you're in the city? And
well, no, I would not at all. I mean, my cousins, no. I mean, my cousins all, like, one of them makes cardboard statues in Tucson, Arizona. My aunt makes teddy bears and beadwork animals for a living. You know, my cousin, one of my other cousins just did a day-long channeling Marilyn Monroe, like a theater performance piece where she lived as Marilyn for a month and did it.
It's like the Val Kilmer playing Mark Twain.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. So, I mean, everybody in my, it's kind of like, you know, it's sort of like a Wes Anderson movie. Unless you do something weird and you know, challenging, you're kicked out of the
family.
An
accountant would be the black sheep.
Yes, pretty much, yes. There's no accountants in my family at all, and I wish there were.
Sure.
Yeah, but my mother has continued her, but she was very comics friendly. And she was really into comics, and so she would read them to me. We read them together. And my grandmother was comics, not averse. She was comics friendly. But I think she didn't like that I read comics that she, I don't know. I think I was kind of raised by my grandparents, by my grandmother and my grandfather. And my grandmother was the one who wanted to homeschool me. So she was kind of controlling. I guess that's what I'm circling around. And so I guess she didn't like it when I was reading things that took attention away from her or more subversive. But in that case, it really was only Little Lulu. And she loved Little Lulu. So she approved of Little Lulu and all the comics reading. So, you know, it was contrary to a lot of images, I guess you could say. I mean, mine was a female comics reading household. My grandfather didn't like comics at all. He was maybe into Terry and the Pirates or comic strips in the newspaper. Sure. So he would read those to me. You know, we're talking about a typical mid-century hippie household.
Now, in a house with that much comics and that much art and that kind of vibe, do you yourself produce artwork? Do you draw?
I was very intimidated because my mother was such a good artist. I mean, she's the kind of artist who could just sit down, you say, draw me, you know, somebody sitting on an elephant and he's fighting a tiger. And she draws it, you know, from her imagination. She can draw everything from her imagination. And my uncle, my mother's brother, was equally talented. And so, like, in my family, you had to have two majors. Okay. You know, like, you had to be either a musician and a painter or a writer and a musician or you had to have two really good skills that you had really developed. So I quickly realized that I couldn't draw at all compared to pretty much everyone else in my family. And maybe I was just, you know, intimidated.
Were you writing at the same time?
I was also
your major?
Writing was my major. No, actually music was my major.
Okay.
Because I was also a child prodigy on the piano, musical prodigy. That was my number one thing. I mean, writing was, I mean, again, everybody in my family had to write. You know, everybody was published here, there, somewhere. So, you know, writing, that was kind of like the easy one. You know, like you have a typewriter and you're typing. I mean, that's not really that hard. But, you know, my writing was very good by family standards.
So by virtue of playing the piano and writing, was there some part of you as a small child thinking, I want to be a songwriter, I was going to be a musician?
Well, that was my first love. That was my first goal in life, was to be a musician. And I studied it for a while, and I wrote songs, I performed.
What kind of songs were they?
I would guess I would compare them to Tom Lehrer, you know, maybe they might be giants. I mean, they're definitely satirical.
Okay, funny.
Quirky, very, very quirky and non-commercial.
Not Brill Building pop
music. No, well, I mean, it was written in the style of that, but it was not, the subject matter was a little too quirky and humorous,
subversive,
I think.
Subversive and listening to a lot of Randy Newman, maybe?
I guess, I mean,
I
wasn't a big Randy Newman fan for whatever reason. I thought his melodies were a little... They weren't up to my standard, you know, but I mean, he is very good. Don't get me wrong, but I wasn't a fan.
In terms of lyrics, it's sarcastic, ironic.
It's funny you mention that because I definitely wasn't a fan of his. Not a fan of Randy Newman, but, you know,
that's
whatever.
Fair.
But musicians hate a lot. You know, musicians tend to hate other musicians, just like Alan Moore hates Grant Morrison.
Sure.
You know, there's always that competitiveness.
Yes. So we're going to take a big leap. We're going to talk about comics. You started the way a lot of people do.
you know, Roy Thomas famously was doing fanzines and then became a pro. And I believe Trina Robbins as well was writing critical pieces. But, you know, I think the exception might be Jules Feiffer, who was a pro and then wrote his book and then went back to making comics and stories. So you were doing that for Comics Journal and Comics Buyer's Guide and those sorts of things. I didn't get to read any of those articles, so we're going to skip it a little
bit. Well, I will tell you right now, because they just made the Comics Journal archives available for $30. If you pay $30, you get to all the old back issues, so...
I blew it. But who had time to read all that?
I know. You know, it's pretty lucky for me you didn't. Let's put it that way. Okay. So, very fortunate, but yeah.
What would I have called, like, if I was reading those, how could I possibly have come at you?
I guess a pretentious twit. I mean, I don't know. I was very pretentious for a youngster. You know,
isn't that the
Comics
Journal?
Yeah, I fit right in. You know, I was the pretentious young girl, elitist girl, I guess. But I wasn't really hardcore elitist. And I mean, I wasn't hardcore enough because I had, you know, I liked John Sable. That was the one book when I was starting to review where I liked John Sable. And that's when Gary was like, you know, Heidi's, we've got to phase her out. And, you know, and looking back, he was right. I don't know what I was getting mainstreamed. I'd moved to Los Angeles and I was definitely getting mainstreamed. But, you know, I mean, I tried. I mean, sometimes I read those old stuff as little as possible, as most people do. But I would say that it's more the opinions that I'm more ashamed of than the writing. I mean, the writing's pretty good, you know. Right. I mean, not to toot my own horn, but I mean, you know, it was, I don't know, this is a very egotistical thing to say, but in my entire life, there's one thing I've never been insecure about, and that's my ability to write.
Well, there was, I was reading on The Beat, there was a Heidi McDonald day.
Yes.
And I can't remember who wrote it. I think it was Brian Heater, said, like, when Heidi writes, you know, people listen. Whether they agree or not is a different story.
Right.
But everybody's, I mean, I know for myself, and we're jumping ahead a little bit, but, you know, I check out The Beat and I prefer when it's, you know, one of your longer pieces where you're sort of getting into something because there's meat on those bones.
Sure. And those, of course, take a long time to do, so that's why I don't do them every day.
But we're going
to
get to that. Let's talk about the Disney Adventures because that's really where you started producing comic.
That's really where I began to influence an entire generation.
Well, it's true.
Yes.
You really did, because there's a bunch of stuff that we're going to cover in this range. I just want to get a sense of when you were there. Were you there before Amy Weingartner, correct?
I was indeed, yes. I preceded her, yes.
And you preceded Steve Bailing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Those are the folks I knew, because I guess around that time, that would have been the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
I was an intern at Marvel in 96, summer 96. And I remember Marvel was trying to get kids stuff up and running. There was a woman there named Jackie something, and I can't remember her last name, and Amy Weingartner were spearheading this thing. That's where Gail Simone.
Yeah, I know who you. Yeah, I think I know who you mean with this Jackie, but I can't remember her either. She didn't. She was
I keep thinking Jackie Lewis, but she's a cartoonist now.
No,
it's a different person.
No, it's a different Jackie. Yeah. But I know who you mean. Yeah.
But Disney Adventures, you were the editor of the comic section. You inherited it from Marv Wolfman.
Right.
When you got that spot as Marv's assistant, and then when you took the thing over, what were your intentions? What was your plan? Did you have a plan?
Well, my plan was to get more, you know, creator-driven, to get more new things into the magazine. That was always my goal. And, you know, it had been Marv's, too. And Marv was a great mentor. I mean, I worked with him as his assistant for 4 years, I guess, and, you know, learned so much from him just about, you know, how to deal with people and how to, most importantly, how to edit a story, because Marv's a brilliant story editor. I mean, I've told this story a few times, but it really is true that, I mean, I can't write stories, you know, I mean, I can fix them or point out what's weak in them, but I can't sit down and say, you know, we're going to write a ghost story now or something like that. That's not a skill that I have, but a lot of people do. And Marv would just be like, oh, we got to write a story about this. He'd be like, and then they go, blah, what if they blah, 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 blah. So I was sitting in his office one day and I said, Marv, how do you do that? How do you just tell these stories? You know, what's your secret? He said, Heidi, it's so easy. All you do is you think of one of your favorite movies, and at that moment, like Len Wein came into the office and said, you know, we got a meeting, you guys. I mean, literally, it's like, and the killer is, And you know, and we never, and
you've
we
never gotten the end
never
of
never got to the end of it. And I even said to Marv a few years ago, I said, Marv, you know, we're sitting in your office. And I said, well, you know, what were you going to say? And he says, I don't know. I don't remember.
Well, I see.
So that was it. I had the one chance to learn how to write stories and I didn't. But, you know,
seems
but
like
he taught
a,
me. To...
A nice writing exercise would be to finish that.
Yeah.
Finish that story with however
yes.
you think it would end.
Yeah, really. You know, maybe there is no secret. Maybe that's what
like
Marv.
I feel like the next words would have been, and rip it off.
That's probably where he was going, but I would not have Marv's facility to rip it off, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I was trying to explain to somebody, oh, you have such imagination. How do you, just when you worry about something, you're kind of writing because you're creating a scenario that doesn't exist.
That's true.
So if you just start writing that down, you've written a story because you made
right.
it all up in your head.
Right.
But
right.
Those would be troubling stories.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it even wasn't, I mean, ripping off maybe is a little harsh, but
yeah,
I mean, I think it was more like, you know, there's only 36 stories.
That's what
so,
they say.
I mean, what do you like? A story about, you know, man against the sea. Okay, well, that could be that's gravity right. or that could be all is lost or, you know, could be Goodbye Chunky Rice or
man
could
versus
be
nature,
Shackleton
man versus man,
or yeah. So.
Classic lit stuff.
Yes.
So bringing in new content to Disney Adventures, you're notable for bringing Bone
right.
to Disney Adventures
right.
and Simpsons comics.
Yes.
Are the two that really
well,
get.
Well, yeah, Simpsons, if you call that creator-owned, but sure, yeah.
I mean, it's Matt Groening comics.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it counts, kind of, yeah, yeah, sure.
What kind of roadblocks were there in the Disney machine? Because despite the fact that Disney wasn't the super megalith it is now, it was still
right.
Disney.
Right.
And I can't imagine that was an easy road to hoe to say, hey, let's publish this thing and we'll make nothing out of it. Like, there's no money to be made except for it makes the magazine better.
You know, that's a really interesting question. And the answer is so shocking in that there were no roadblocks at all. Like, being the 90s, Disney Adventures really was this lab. It was a petri dish. It was really one of the only creator-owned aspects of the whole Disney empire. They had Hyperion Books as well, but Disney Adventures was just about the only place where this was allowed. And it was started, that's because it was started by this guy named Michael Linton, who now runs Sony Pictures. So he's had a pretty successful career. He also ran Penguin Books. He also ran AOL. So, you know, he Disney Adventures, he just moved. Oh, he ran Touchstone Pictures. So he went from running Disney Adventures to running a movie studio. Okay, so he had a whole vision. And luckily, he was so persuasive that he talked that division of Disney into saying we can do new things that we don't own. And I don't even know if that exists now at Disney. I kind of think maybe it doesn't. I mean, they sold Hyperion. I don't think they even own that anymore. I know with Disney Press, there are some things. Because, you know, with a book publisher, you can't really be that way. But it was an anomaly. It was a very, very rare. So there was no... I mean, I would fight sometimes for certain things that I liked. My tastes were a little bit more out there, I think, than some of the editors above me. But they were pretty supportive. I mean, all in all, I mean, they knew I had pretty good taste. And, you know, Bone was a huge hit. You know, and I always point out, you know, Marv is the one who said Bone is great first. I mean, it didn't take a real comics genius to see that Bone was great, you know. But, yeah. I mean, Marv spotted it right off the bat. And, you know, I was able to kind of bring it to fruition there. But, you know, the Simpsons comics was probably my greatest moment. And, you know, I try not to be one of those people who's like, you know, I was 25 years ago and I, you know, I had that 30-yard run against the, you know, state. But I will say that was pretty awesome because we were sitting around in one of our staff meetings at Disney and they were like, what about the Simpsons? Those are great. Couldn't we get the Simpsons in? And somebody said, but they're like Fox. Can we do that? And we're like, well, we could try. And I was something like, well, you know, Matt Groening just launched Bongo Comics. And I am friends with Matt Groening, so let me call and see. So I called Matt Groening, but I remember I was at some kind of conference, and he called me back. And I mean, we didn't even have cell phones then, so I was talking on some house phone or something. But I was like, look, Matt, you know, Disney Adventures really would love to excerpt your comics. Maybe you could create a short 8-page comic for us. You could run with us originally, and then you could collect them all later on. And it'll be great exposure for Bongo. And, of course, we get to do The Simpsons. It's like, great, let's do it. My lawyer will drop the papers. That was it. You know, I mean, literally with one phone call, I was able to put Fox's number one property in Disney's magazine. And That was pretty cool. That was that was a real, you know, like, great moment, actually. Just being able to, you know, with the level and the skill to be able to, you know, the what's the word? Believability, I guess. I don't want to use the word authority, but the trust.
Credibility.
The credibility. Yeah, the credibility to be able to make a deal like that. So then we put Bart Simpson on the cover. So, you know, I mean, this was the go-go licensing 90s. I mean, you know, there was a list of Olympic mascots, and they showed the one from the 96 Olympics in Atlanta. And it's just the most god-awful thing where he's wearing Nike shoes and he has, like, stars and striped tights, something like that. It's just the most hideous thing. And it was just, and I forget the name. It was, you know, Willie the, I don't know, it was awful, just awful. And they said, this is the, you know, the nadir of 90s licensing. And I was like, oh, my God, that's, you know, I'm glad you remembered some of the high points, because that's what I, you know, a lot of us spent a lot of time in the 90s doing, was awful licensed mascot-y things for everything. You know, everybody wanted to have a mascot, you know. Yeah. I mean, another thing was Lego comics, which they still do very successfully. But I was a test case for that. And that was really difficult. So.
You mentioned licensed stuff, and you went from Disney Adventures to DC Comics.
Yes.
And you worked on a lot of their licensed books that they called Johnny DC. It wasn't called that at the time.
Yes. The kids line, yes.
And I like talking to people who've done kids properties and licensed kids properties. I mean, I mostly do SpongeBob comics now. I pay attention to that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of a line. There was an interview with Kyle Baker in the Comics Journal years ago where he mentions how at that point, this was after your time at DC, and I think I might have even left Marvel.
My time was very brief, so it was really hard not to be after my time.
But he was basically, he was calling out the comics business, which he's want to do, for being a business where Scooby-Doo, a world-known, internationally known property, is like, DC can't sell Scooby-Doo.
Right.
And when that's the situation, something's wrong.
Yes.
And I want to talk to you a little bit about that, because it's to this day, it's still pretty much the case. There's an outlier of My Little Pony or Adventure Time, but SpongeBob comics or Scooby-Doo or any of these.
But I wouldn't call Adventure Time and My Little Pony outliers at all.
No,
I would.
I'm saying they're outliers because they do better than.
Right. But no, if you notice, Boom and IDW have both said, we're going to really push these things. And
well, that's true.
When they push
them, good point.
Incredibly, they find a large audience. When you have comics that are based on very popular properties and you push them, they tend to do very well. I mean, I have never in all my, well, okay, in all my, you know, 12 years, 10 years, however long it is of being a journalist, I guarantee I've never gotten a press release from Warner Brothers about a Scooby-Doo comic.
Except for this new one with Batman in it.
That might be the very first one. But you notice that just happened. And also they started doing like Little Gotham and all these sort of things. So they kind of have reboosted that. You know, I mean, that's not entirely true. They did do the whole Tiny Titans line and all that sort of stuff. So there was a brief period. But I still, you know, I mean, it's very, very rare.
But I mean, so to the point where you were working at Disney Adventures, and you clearly, even in your work now, have an interest and a passion for, I mean, you as a child were reading comics.
Yeah, of course.
So it's clearly something you're interested in. After all these years of seeing sort of the same patterns repeated,
right.
In fact, it feels like, and I talk about this with Chris Jeruso and other kids comics people in the direct market, you know, the train started leaving the station a long time ago as what I like to refer to as the verticalization of comics sort of happened, where everything started to get, I don't want to say mature, but, you know, whatever the word is.
Dark and edgy.
Yeah. Again, I want to avoid as many cliches as possible.
Yeah, but I mean, but that's not even a cliche. It's just what it is.
I guess. Or more navel-gazing.
Yeah, sure.
I suppose. But at this point, the train is so far gone.
Right.
That kids' comics are now, you know, it's the purview of Raina Telgemeier and Kazuki Buishi and Jimmy Gallanly, and it's not in comic stores anymore.
Right.
Even Archie Comics is like, yeah, we do better elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Lincoln Pierce, you know, Big Nate, those books sell 1,000 copies. I mean, and you know what the number one book last year was, all in all of publishing, was the Wimpy Kid book.
Sure.
And I mean, you work on SpongeBob, so you don't need me to tell you that when you actually do this material well and put it in front of children, they actually enjoy it.
Oh, they love it, except, again, SpongeBob's a weird case.
Yes.
Because it is a direct market book first, and
right.
It's a pretty small operation. It's actually people think it's a Nickelodeon thing, and it's not.
It published through
Bongo distributes
for Bongo,
it.
right.
The publisher is Steve Hillenburg, the guy who created the show. In the same way that Matt Groening is the publisher of Simpsons Con. They have the same lawyer.
Yeah. Susan Grody.
Yes.
The terrifying Susan Grody.
I didn't say it.
Yeah. No, she knows.
I get my checks from there.
She's very happy if I say that. So she's, quite a lawyer. She's the best. She got Matt Groening's signature on every piece of Simpsons art. It's a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
You can do a lot worse than Susan Grody. Yeah. Yes.
But is that something, I had Raina on here and we talked about her trajectory and how, not to say she isn't talented because she is, but it really was a lot of right place, right time, and just hitting those marks right when the graphic novel business started.
Right.
That train started its road. Did you see that coming? Which might be a bit presumptuous to think anybody saw it coming.
Well, I mean, did you see it coming in terms of knowing that children actually liked comics?
No, that the ball would be picked up outside of the direct
market. Yeah. Well, it had to be. But, I mean, you're leaving money on the table. I mean, I don't, cliches, try to avoid them, but, low-hanging fruit.
Yes.
I mean, the one thing
you can use cliches.
Yes,
I want to avoid them.
Yes, but the one thing I learned at Disney, I have to back up because this topic does get me quite incensed, but, somebody wrote to me recently, because I have been writing some real, idle topplers, I guess is a good way to put it, some real, call it as I see it, idle toppler posts. And somebody wrote to me something like, well, you must be sad to see this part of comics ending. And I'm like, I hate to say it, but I'm thrilled because this was never my industry, even as a kid looking around at the if you went in the late 60s, that fabled newsstand and looked around, the variety of books that was on the stands was incredible, you know? And then we went into this very narrow area and that nearly killed the industry and yet saved it at the same time.
Yes.
So, I mean, in that superhero world, I might have read some superhero comics that I enjoyed very much. I had my fan period, but that was never my world. I always, always wanted to widen it and to make more people such as yourself or Raina's. I mean, there's so many people who want to do all ages material and they're so talented and they had no outlet. So it was very frustrating. It was really great that I was able to offer a very small outlet for them when I worked at Disney Adventures.
And those people certainly, I mean, I found a news group thread or something where, the praises were sung. Evan Dorkin, who was very, very often a curmudgeon, certainly was,
He did a great, great strip. Which
said very nice things,
yes,
which is always.
I know, that was the miracle.
Stuff from Evan is great.
Miracle on Hauser Street, man. Yeah, so, I mean, of course, I knew that this was a market that was ripe for exploitation.
What stopped you from getting out in front of it?
Well, I mean, at the same time, I think I was, I think it was a lot harder at that time. I mean, when I left Disney and went to DC, the internet was just getting started. We didn't have all the tools. I mean, now you just go and you print something up, you know. I mean, I probably could have. I guess I didn't know. I have always worked. I mean, I've always been very corporate. I mean, you were joking earlier about the accountant. I mean, I'm the closest thing to a corporate person in my family by far. So, I mean, I was just addicted to having a paycheck every week and health insurance and all that stuff. And so I guess, I would talk to people, but nobody was interested in doing it. I mean, I think at that time, it was the worst time. I mean, 1998, 1999, as I'm sure you know, having worked at Marvel,
those were my years.
Those were the nadir of comics.
We were a bankrupt company.
There was a bankrupt company.
Yeah.
But things at DC were just as bad. There was really no light on the horizon. There was no new things. There was sales were just awful. They were really, really bad. Although not as bad as they are now. And yet they seemed worse then, they definitely seemed worse because this is why that was the worst time. The top selling book, there was a few months there where the top selling book sold 75,000 copies. Yeah. That's just not very many copies for the top of the industry.
Yeah.
And so when the book industry came along, books came to the rescue, Borders, Barnes and Noble, about 2000, 2001, and just this serendipitous things happened, including Fantagraphics and Journal Quarterly really having some great books, you know? But, I mean, Only Mouse existed. This was before Persepolis and Fun Home. And I think when Persepolis came along, I think that was 2002, because it was right after 9/11. And then Fun Home was like 2005. So I think that whole 2002, 2005 period, I mean, I think Persepolis is the book that really busted it wide open. And when I saw this new audience that was coming in through other channels, I knew that it was all going to be okay, you know? And so, I mean, it's a long-winded, windy answer, but I just never, I just knew because I worked with these people and I knew their mindset and I knew they would never, ever, ever, ever be interested in promoting kids' comics. And they haven't.
And by that point, you had sort of made the shuttle to Publishers Weekly, right?
Yes.
And then you were really able to sort of grab hold of it.
Well, when I left DC, I went immediately to launch the website, The Pulse.
Yes, I remember The Pulse.
Which you might remember, yes. So that would be 2002.
It was you and Jen Contino. Correct?
Me and Jen Contino, yeah. And at that point, there was CBR and there was Newsarama, and we were kind of like the third website. We were the third daily news website, and so there wasn't like 90,000 others. Blogging had just begun at that point. But, you know, that was a pretty big, bite to chew off, you know, like going from editing a few magazines where you had a whole support staff behind you to really just flying by the seat of our pants, where we were kind of making it up as we went along. Because a lot of the things that we did, CBR Newsarama didn't do, you know. I mean, there was that other guy, Rob Worley, who had like comic book movie news, but there was so little of it then. I mean, there wasn't enough of it to run a whole website like there is now. But I started into, I mean, there was definitely more movies coming in. So I started integrating more of the, you know, kind of showbiz coverage into the comics coverage. And there were so many other celebrities getting into it. So, I mean, I'm not saying like I invented this. It's kind of like the, you know, a no-brainer. But we were definitely pushing the envelope. I think we served notice with Newsarama and CBR. But especially Newsarama, we were very competitive with them. There was always a fight, you know. Jonah and I have always had a, you know, I don't go to the game with him, but, you know, I would, you know, but my husband does. But, you know, we've always been friends. But Newsarama and The Pulse were very competitive.
Before we launch into the internet, which is vast and wide.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about Vertigo and Why the Last Man, which I know is a topic that is often tread upon.
Sure.
But you are the first editor on Why the Last Man.
Yes.
You put that team together. Brian had the
pitch. I chose the book from all the pitches Brian gave me and said, that's the one.
Well, Brian is awesome. There's no denying it. I knew him when he was starting at Marvel. He would come by, him and Jay Ferber and Devin Grayson were that
the
team.
Yes.
And I remember when Brian got Swamp Thing, it was very exciting. Mm-hmm. And I'm maybe one of 50 people that liked it.
I appreciate that.
No problem. It was
awesome.
I don't think you were on the book yet, but I think it's the second or third issue. It tells two stories at once, and it's like her story and then like the story of the forest or something. And the interweaving, the art and the words, it was perfect.
Yeah.
That, you know, sent Brian an email like, this thing was amazing. Well done. And then Why the Last Man?
Mm-hmm.
So my boss at Marvel is Tom Brevoort. Mm-hmm. One of his mantras was creators get the credit, editors get the blame.
Yes.
So you are credited with putting this team together and getting this pitch through the system.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I have is, what can we credit you with and what can we blame you for on Why the Last Man?
I have nothing to do with it because Brian pretty much did it all himself. But I did say when he started doing the book, I was like, you know, looking for an artist. I said, why don't you try Pia Guerra? And, you know, he saw her. There was that dinner in San Diego where I think Pia came to the dinner and she was showing around her samples, and every writer was like, I want to work with her. But, you know, Brian won the sweepstakes. So, you know, Brian gave me credit for one thing, and that was putting in the first issue the last page, which is that says, you know, out of the world's clergy, 5% are female. Out of the stats. And then that to me was the, you know, like there was no way you were not going to come back to this book after the stats.
That's a great, I mean, again, I read it when it came out, but that page does so much world building in an instant.
Right. And they don't put it in the collection, which really pisses me off. But, you know, by then I was already gone. So In fact, I don't think I was even at, you know, I mean, I left Vertigo under unhappy circumstances, but, you know, it all, now it's all water under the bridge. So, you know, I'm not holding a grudge, and I don't think anybody holds a grudge against me, but I don't think I was even there when the first issue came out.
Well, that brings up the next question, which is, you know, you left under those circumstances.
Yes.
And you know, within a few years, Y becomes Y.
Right.
Capital
Y. Right.
Is there a part of you that has, like, this satisfaction of, like, yeah, now what?
Oh, geez, Louise. Absolutely. Because, you know, you asked me what was mine about it. And, you know, I'm sure, Brian, I'm sure somewhere in my vault, I bet you I have that email that Brian had sent with his pitches. And The Last Man on Earth is Kennard. But, you know, he'd put those statistics in there. So I saw it isn't just going to be about how many women can I have sex with. It's going to be about how is this world going to run. And I said, people are really going to get that. I mean, that's something that everyone can relate to. And that was that aspect of the book that made it so much more than, you know, the Medusa Chain or Zardoz. There's so many other versions of it that, you know, I mean, it's been done many, many times and it's still being done. So I think that was, I mean, I really wanted to have a book that people would, anyone could read. That wasn't so esoteric, that had some kind of universality to it. And I still run into people who are saying, my son brought home this comic and he loved it so much. And it was called Why the Last Man. And I read it. And it was so good. I mean, I still meet people just who don't know I had anything to do with the book.
They just know you're in comics.
They just know I'm comics. And they will just say, oh, you know, I read this really great book called Why the Last Man. And, you know, sometimes I say I had something to do with it. And sometimes I don't, because that's, you know, I mean, it was, like I said, I try not to, you know, live on past glories. But I'm super thrilled. I'm super thrilled that book has done so well and that it really lives on. And, you know, they're still talking about, you know, keeping on, maybe adapting it. But, I mean, the trades sell and sell and sell.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. And I think it's, you know, Brian's great. Brian's really great. But, you know, let me stand up here.
Yes, stand up.
Well, let me stand up for Pia, because
absolutely,
I think she did a great job on the book drawing it. Now, I think it was also, you know, Vertigo books are famous for their brown, their, you know, crap coloring. And, you know, why it was colored in that way. And, you know, it's not very dynamic. That's just how Vertigo books are colored. But, you know, people are always saying what a bad cartoonist Pia is. And I'm like, a lot of people are just like, she's a boring cartoonist or she's not a good. And I'm like, what the, you know, what are you talking about? Like, there was so much humanity and so many great designs and suspenseful moments and, like, really wonderful things that Pia brought to that book. And, you know, I just want to say, I've been thinking about this for a long time.
And the storytelling is impeccable.
Yeah, it's impeccable, you know? And, I mean, she did have a trouble drawing a monthly book. And, you know, they brought in Goran Suzuka to do it. And, you know, his stuff is great, too. But, you know, P is the one who made that book. And I want to point out, and I'm actually waving my finger now.
He is waving her finger.
Yeah, I am waving my finger because, you know, Brian was doing the same book at the time, Ex Machina, with Tony Harris, who, say what you will, is one of the best cartoonists of the last 20 years. I mean, he's one of my favorites. I love Starman. He's great. Undisputed great cartoonist. And if you put down two books, which is the one that gets picked up?
Why the Last Man, as far as I know.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So to me, it's really a question of, you know, did this book communicate?
Well, that goes back to the Scott McCloud iconography, the simpler images. You know, Bone, same idea. Mm-hmm. It's such a simple visual that you can latch onto it and follow this thing.
Right.
Clarity.
Exactly. So there's a clarity and there's a communication to Pia's work and why that is, you know, it's really exemplary. And it's one of the reasons why the book has become a, you know, neo-classic. So.
Last thing about corporate comics before we jump into the internet. You had three assistants that I'm aware of.
Oh.
John Green.
Yes.
Which is in the Adventures. Cliff Chang, also at Disney Adventures, and I believe, did he go with you to Vertigo?
No, he left first.
And then Steve Bunch.
Oh, yes, that's right.
I'm not sure if you hired Steve Bunch or he was assigned to you or how that...
No, it was my idea. Well, somebody said, why did you hire Bunch? It might have been Scott Dunbier who said, why don't you hire Bunch? And I did, and he was great, so...
Because Bunch was in the bullpen when I was at Marvel, and he was in the bullpen at DC, and it's rare for somebody to go bullpen to editorial. I only know of two instances, Steve Bunch and Lisa Hawkins, the two I can think of.
Oh, yeah, Lisa...
So So that's three assistants that have art backgrounds more than writing backgrounds. Yeah. I was an assistant. Tom Brevoort, I had an art. I came from an art cartoonist place. Was there something particularly appealing about that in your assistants, or did that not factor in, like, oh,
well,
these guys
can draw? Well, it's funny that you say that, because... Well,
you may have had other assistants.
I did, actually. Other assistants that I had include Gregory Benton was my assistant for a while, but he did my art assist at Disney. You know, he's coming back. He's doing a lot of stuff. Jason Little, who's another really awesome cartoonist, was also kind of... They were, like, at Disney, my assistant usually was an art director. Like, he had to do all the production work. So that's why I hired artists. And I mean, I think really having knowledge of production before the internet was awfully important. I mean, you know, I'm sure you know this from being at Marvel. Like, before everybody just scanned and FTP'd everything, it was a very arduous process to get this artwork, you know, corrected and slapped down, and the lettering had to be done. And I mean, you know, it was a physical process. So, I mean,
I was lucky enough that when I started, the FTP had come into play. But I certainly saw paste up boards, and I'm aware of that technical aspect.
Yes, yeah. So it was a very arduous task, and you definitely had to have someone who knew what they were doing. And it's funny, because when we first started doing computer lettering, which I was against, of course, I was, you know, because I'd seen so much shitty lettering, and you know, with hand lettering, you still had that handmade feeling to it. But poor Jason Little was my assistant then, and it would come back and all the lettering would be all jaggy and digitized. And of course, I just had a fit. I was like, why doesn't this look good? And he just, you know, Jason's like the nicest person on earth. And I really got upset about it. I was, you know, the closest I would come, I think, to ranting and raving around the office. And he was just like, oh, they tell me it's the three plates aren't trapping and blah, 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 blah. And so we never, like, did solve it entirely. To me, where the artwork would be smooth, whereas the lettering would be jagged. And, you know, now I know what to do with Illustrator. And, you know, now, I mean, edited a few books freelance. And, oh, God, Illustrator versus Photoshop. I mean, there's still digital, you know, all these mysterious things that happen. And, you know, I still pick up books and they still have that. Like, they still see that jagged lettering. I'm still like, you know, it still doesn't look as good as the original, you know? So, but of course you can fix it now, but it's still an easy mistake to make. So,
sure.
But anyway, those are the kind of things. I mean, if you want to get into the minutiae of making comics, you know, all those, I'm sure nobody noticed them but me, but, you know, and I'm not even anal about it the way a lot of editors are.
I just didn't know if there was any, for you as somebody who was hiring people, if there was an advantage of, oh, this person thinks visually. Just by a rule,
compared to
a writer person.
Well, I did. I almost always did hire someone, and I never thought of it that way, actually. But now that you mention it, I mean, I guess I did, because it is really so much visualized, and, you know, just like, I think you have to have a different sense to be an editor of comics or to be a cartoonist, you know, as opposed to somebody who writes or someone who draws. But all the great writers were artists first. You know, Grant Morrison wanted to be an artist. Alan Moore wanted to be an artist. You know, nowadays, Bendis, you know.
Who was an artist.
Who was an artist, who drew, perfectly capable of drawing his own comics.
Jeff Parker as well.
Jeff Parker. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, Rick Remender is an artist. Jonathan Hickman is an artist.
There's a whole generation that comes from Walt Simonson, John Byrne, Alan Davis,
Absolutely,
Frank Miller.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's what I always aspired to, is like, oh, these guys write and draw their own stuff.
Right, right.
We all want to do that, really.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's why I always make a distinction between an artist and a cartoonist.
I do as well.
Yes. So I guess I always wanted to have a cartoonist as an assistant. I had never actually noticed that before, but there's another guy who I had as my assistant very briefly, Zachary Rao, who went on to work at Tokyo Pop, and he drew, but not published, but he did do his own little comics. So, you know, I guess I just, yeah, I mean, that's a great skill to have, since I don't have it. So, right. You know, you have to have a team.
Sure.
Teamwork.
Absolutely. Unless you're doing everything yourself.
Right.
And even Jeff Smith has his wife who's helping him out.
Yeah. Oh, he has a colorist. Yeah.
Well, now he has a whole team.
Now he has a, you know,
but
yeah.
If you go way back, yeah. There's the two of them.
Yes. Right? Yes. Yeah. I think, yeah.
Against
the people
world.
Who did it all by themselves aren't doing it anymore.
Is that Dave? Dave Sim didn't. He didn't do his backgrounds.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the internet and what you do now. You know, it's a big topic, but we'll cover as much as we can. Do you consider yourself, are you a journalist? Are you a pundit? Are you an advocate? Do you define yourself in any one term? Are you percentages of each of those things?
Well, I guess I'm a percentage.
Paparazzo?
Yeah, I guess I'm a percentage of all those. I think I really wanted to be a journalist when I first started, but I think it becomes more and more difficult to do that. So I think I'm actually, I think as one ages, one becomes a pundit. Because one just sits there saying, and you know, what they really need to do is promote them more. I mean, it's funny. You asked me a question that I kind of dodged earlier about Publishers Weekly and, you know, working there and writing about.
I'm not even sure it was a question as much as a reference point.
But I mean, I think like getting in there at the time I did, which again was 10 years ago, yikes, which is when this whole, you know, Persepolis revolution was happening. And I was able to provide a lot of coverage of this for people who didn't know about it at that time. And so to really fill a much needed void, as they say. But, you know, I was able to really do, I mean, groundbreaking is absolutely the wrong word. It sounds horrible, but no one else is doing it. No one else is providing this kind of coverage to this audience. So it was very unique and it was a great opportunity to kind of, you know, set the tone, set the tone and kind of establish the narrative as I saw it. And, you know, with Calvin Reed, my boss there also. But, you know, it was definitely a great time to establish the narrative and promote the things that you liked. But, you know, luckily, as Gary Groth had discovered many years ago, I like an awful lot of things. So as for, I mean, I think definitely with the Beat, I mean, I've been doing it 10 years and I've been doing the same thing for 10 years. And I mean, I just personally don't think the internet stays the same for 3 months, let alone 10 years, you know. And that's why, I mean, I know everybody loves Tom Spurgeon. Tom's, you know, blog is the same as it was. It hasn't, you know, it doesn't even have tags. God bless. And I mean, it's the best, you know, he's the number one and, you know, with winning the awards and then everything. And so certainly, you know, change is not necessary, but I guess for myself, I do feel it is because I just don't stay, you know, I'm mercurial, I guess. I get bored easily.
Now, you mentioned Tom Spurgeon, which is great because in an interview, now you are more often interviewing or reporting,
right?
Not being interviewed, but there is one interview with you that Tom Spurgeon did.
Yes.
And it's a good one.
Last year with yes.
Yeah. And one of the things that you said, we talked about journalism and proper training for journalism. And one of the, I think is a rough quote, is that things, the training for journalism are things that probably don't matter in the era of crowdfunding.
Right.
And I wanted to understand that better. Because I'm not sure I understand.
Well,
what
I think
you mean.
We don't have any middlemen now. You know, I mean, is Kickstarter a middleman? I mean, we don't need people telling. I mean, people don't get their news about what they like from me telling them. I mean, that's not entirely true, but I mean, people don't need so many guides to say you should check this out. I mean, I think they discover things on their own. And it's a lot less now. I mean, you know, how did you discover music in the olden days? I mean, you know, you read a magazine or you'd go to the record shop and look at them. You know, you
somebody
were the early.
Older tells you.
Yeah. Or, but the classic way is your buddy says, you know, have you heard Portishead? Okay. And then you listen to Portishead. And I think that's kind of how it's worked for a long time. But I don't think that, you know, Facebook liking and tweeting and blah, 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 all that, all these new institutionalized methods we have of your buddy saying, have you heard Portishead? So, I mean, I'm just saying people are very good at finding what they like, you know, and they don't look for somebody else to really hold their hand anymore.
But something else you said, I keep quoting
sure.
Is that the internet, and I do not disagree with this at all, your phrasing was it's like Times Square on New Year's and everybody has a noisemaker.
Right.
So, on some level, a site like The Beat or Commerce Reporter or whatever does something to shed a light on, amidst all this noise, here's a noisemaker you should
be paying
attention to.
Well, that's, that, you know, I guess there's old people who can't find things, so they want to go to a blog, maybe. I don't know.
I mean, people still read movie reviews.
Yeah. No. I mean, I'm overstating it, but, I mean, it's frustrating when you've been doing it, you know, as long as I have, and then just when you think, oh, yeah, I got this figured out. And then, you know, along comes Upworthy or, you know,
BuzzFeed,
you know, or I mean, first was Gawker. I mean, I could understand what Gawker was doing, you know,
sure.
And then came content farms. But Google killed the content farms. But then came BuzzFeed, and BuzzFeed, you know, was Google proof. But now there's that one that's all uplifting stories. I just mentioned Upworthy. However, an end is at hand of all of this, actually. I mean, it has. The Times Square has just gotten really crowded. I think the ball's going to drop. And I think people are going to go home, maybe a little tired, a little bedraggled. Really,
well, you just posted a recent piece about the content. I can't remember the disparity or whatever the phrase was.
Yeah, yeah. The crisis of, or the doom of content, you know, marketing. Yeah.
Too much content, not enough time.
But it was, and it was brilliant. I mean, and it was something that we all feel, but it really pointed out. It said, if you want to stand out, I mean, we were talking earlier about your podcast. You know, obviously you do a very in-depth job with your podcast.
Hey, thanks.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's, you know, how do you stand out? How do you,
Good question.
And you have to really put your all into it. You know, I just did a podcast last week. I did Jimmy Aquino's podcast, Comic News Insider. And Jimmy promotes the hell out of his podcast. And he's great at getting people who have their own followings on the show, you know, and that's really smart. So there's different ways of doing it. But, you know, the graph you're talking about just showed that as there's more and more and more content, the time you have to spend to promote your content as opposed to the audience you're getting, it's an inverse proportion. And just the time graph was soaring. And, you know, that's bad enough for us who are doing this in our living rooms. But really what they're talking about is, I mean, probably Coke's going to get attention. But all these smaller brands who are trying to create their own content or doing advertising that looks like editorial content, you know, oh, why don't you tweet? Why don't you get a blog? I mean, now everybody has it. There's that, you know, now we really do have to start doing our own Upworthy stories. You know, like after I went to Trader Joe's, you know, what the checker told me would blow my mind.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think we're at a precipice. And I actually, if I've survived this long, I will survive, you know, until there is absolute complete lack of anything resembling a blog on the internet, which I still think people like their daily. I think they like daily content. I think they do like go. I mean, I know I like go to my favorite sites every day. So for the, you know, five or six people who I'm one of their favorite sites, well then, you know, they'll still come there.
What, in your estimation, you edit The Beat. You are the proprietor of all things The Beat. You have different writers working. What determines whether something is an actual story or not? I mean, I imagine because the stories show up everywhere. That somebody, whether it's Marvel or DC, or sends out some kind of notification, hey, you know, this person's going to be this guy in a movie, or we got this new book coming out. How do you determine which thing you're going to give your attention to? What's a story? What's a lead that you're going to follow?
Right. Boy, I don't know. I mean, whatever I'm doing at the moment, you know.
I mean, you've been upfront in past conversations and interviews where you said, like, yeah, sometimes I put pictures of Chris Hemsworth on the site because that's going to get hits. It's going to bring people there.
Yeah.
You
but,
like Chris Hemsworth.
Right. And I mean, I like Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like I'm doing something that I dislike.
Right, right.
I
You're
mean,
not doing
I,
anything.
That's really the highlight of the week when I get to look for pictures of Chris Hemsworth and find just the perfect one to put up on The Beat. So, you know, I mean, I could easily do more of that and I probably should. But, you know, my readers, I have a really short attention span. I guess I have ADD. I have mild ADD like a lot of people. Who are on the internet, and the internet makes it worse, as many studies have shown. So what makes it newsworthy? I you know, it does get harder and harder. I look back at the first day of The Beat, the first week of The Beat, and like I did three stories a day. I mean, and it was like nothing at all. And, you know, I'd make up one. And I, you know, I remember people were like, oh, thank God. Now this is the only site I need to read. And I'm like, wow, what world were we living in? Because I just couldn't possibly. I mean, last year I had a lot of writers and it really was going great. And I really loved the team that I had. And then they all got other jobs, you know, which always tends to happen with people that I hire and, you know, for whatever reason, or most people hire. But, you know, people move on. I mean, I wasn't paying them a living wage or even very much, you know, so they all got different jobs and moved on. And I haven't found the next generation. I'm kind of looking around a little bit. Maybe find some people who kind of want to go in with me on The Beat, become partners, and, you know, in not partners like, oh my God, I'm going to, you know, invest $60,000 in the site. I mean, just, you know, hop on board. But what makes a story? So I do have one little criterion that is sort of more like, what does this story have an impact? You know, and a lot of stuff that I run doesn't have an impact. But I try to be, is this a change? Is this a, you know, is this affecting somebody? Is it affecting the business? Is there a behind the scenes story that's really interesting here? Is there more to this than meets the eye? So I think those kind of stories are the ones I try to focus on now, because people are desperate for information. They're desperate to read more than the press release. And a lot of times I do run the press release, but at least I try to do only the ones that have some significance to my mind. Like Comixology sent out one about being the number one grossing non-game app on the iPad. To me, that's a very significant story.
Sure.
And they threw in there that they'd had 6 billion pages of comics served, but 4 billion this year. 4 billion pages of comics. That's a hell of a lot. That's a lot of comics. That's huge. I mean, that's really something people should be thinking about, because physical sales didn't go down. And so we have a huge audience for comics now, or a potentially huge audience for comics. And, you know, people need to hop on that. I better get on it.
They were cheaper. That's my bailiwick.
No.
The digital
versions,
I mean.
Well, maybe. But you know the reason why they're not cheaper, so they can go on sale. You know that, right?
Yeah. I wait for the sales.
Yeah, and they know that if they put it up at 99 cents, you might not buy it. But if it's $1.99 and then suddenly it's 99 cents, then you're going to be like, I better get on that. That's internet marketing. Okay. That's how people do it.
There's a whole separate, that's like, I think of the bigger world outside that doesn't know that that's going to happen.
Right.
That's not getting the Comixology email that tells you what's on sale that week.
Right.
Again, that's my own, this is about you.
Right. But anyway, I mean, I think that's a pretty significant story. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why I try to have more writers who are younger than me and aren't as jaded as I am is because I don't always see what's important, you know, in a Marvel or DC story. Even now, it's like, oh, this happened to Steve Morris, one of my writers, loves Pixie. I mean, so something happened to Pixie. I'm like, okay, well, Steve, you better write that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I it's too much for one person, even me.
Yeah. I mean, eventually, you know, there's a cycle of characters dying and coming back. And at a certain point, like, this, none of it's a story. It's just
right. Information
you're passing along.
Right.
But everybody's saying it.
But to somebody, that's an important story.
Sure.
You know, that every death is somebody's first death.
And every resurrection is
somebody's
first resurrection. Yes. You've been around in the business for a long time. You have a lot of access. You know a lot of people, particularly in the freelance world.
Sure.
Something that's brought up in another podcast I listen to called Common Sense, which is mostly about the media and politics and that sort of thing, is that there's a discrepancy between access and what you kind of really can say before losing that access.
That's true.
How do you balance that? Because I'm sure there are things you know and things you could write about that are damning.
Right.
And you know, could take people out at the knees.
Right.
But you don't because you're a decent person, maybe. Maybe because if you were to do that, you'd never hear anybody talk again.
Well, I have one very simple guideline,
okay. Which
is that I won't write anything I wouldn't say to a person's face.
Okay.
So that really is, you know, that creates at least something where, because I do, I have a lot of friends. And, you know, my friends know that I speak my mind. And so if I would be, you know, in the bar with somebody, I'd be like, you know what, I really didn't like that book. And here's why, you know, I mean, maybe I probably wouldn't say it in print that harshly.
Yeah.
But I would say, oh, it was disappointing. You know, I mean, I don't know the people who make this S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show, so I was just trashing it today, you know, and that felt really good. But, I mean, it's definitely very hard, and this is really, I mean, I think we're all connected now. I mean, access is so much easier to get to a lot of people via electronic means, whether we're Facebook friends or whatever. So it does become a real question sometimes. And, I mean, I think people know where I stand. I mean, I'm not going to do salacious gossipy, you know, so-and-so was leaving the hotel room with such and such. And, you know, even Rich Johnson doesn't do that kind of stuff, although he's sort of dabbled. He dabbles with it here and there, but he doesn't really need to. I don't think there'd be any bigger audience for that kind of stuff, honestly. I don't think, you know, the traffic would all. I mean, I had huge traffic, I will admit, for the recent sexual harassment stuff. The traffic was huge.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not going to make the sexual harassment beat, you know, because it would get old real fast.
Sure. And then what about other sort of journalistic ideals, like, not that these stories tend to come up, but protecting a source, or do you...
Yeah, I do a lot of that. I do that a lot, actually, because people do tell me things, and I'm always very careful to make it very deep cover where, you know, I might be saying, like, I mean, not that I want everybody in this time-starved world to pore over my every word, but sometimes you should read carefully what I write, okay? Because I usually try to, if I do write something, I try to pack a little bit more in there than is immediately apparent. If I can't come right out and say something, sure. I try to at least leave a signpost so you can kind of figure it out yourself.
Sure.
Or hint strongly, perhaps, maybe.
Without giving up your
throat. Yeah, and I mean, I talk when I do podcasts, when I do the PW podcast, here's a hint, I do say a lot more in the podcast than I put in writing. So if you listen to the hot podcast, it's kind of like a bonus.
I want to talk about a specific element in the beat that I have a little confusion/beef with.
Okay.
Yeah. Now we're getting real.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And now he's getting personal.
I want to talk about the Brokeback pose.
Oh.
And I want to talk about, because it was at this point, it's a couple years ago that you were really hitting, banging that gong pretty hard. Although recently you've sort of popped up.
Yeah, well, I have a Tumblr and I was like, oh shit, I better do this Tumblr. So, you know.
So for me, it seems like a cause without a clear definition.
Mm.
And then I'll explain. Because it's, on the one hand, on the surface, it's like, oh, this pose is impossible. But I think in your very first sort of big post about it, several cartoonists chimed in like, no, this is completely possible.
Right, right, right. And I post people in the Brokeback all
post
the time. Yeah,
human figures making this thing.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And then I was like, okay, maybe it's like a lot of these are bad drawings.
Yeah.
Like, is this just a bad art thing? All right, that's fair. But because, you know, Adam Hughes never shows up and Alan Davis never shows up. And it's always just like this very distorted.
Yeah.
And then that becomes a sort of gray argument over how much is exaggeration in cartooning and how much is,
right,
you know, bad, just bad drawing.
Yeah.
And then there is that question of, is it an argument about the over-sexualization and the hyped up nature of
right.
all this stuff, the costumes and the whole nine yards. So I guess I just want clarity on what
well, I
did,
I mean,
what
it's,
the fight
yeah,
is.
I mean, the answer is yes. But I mean, I think on Tumblr, there's tons of Tumblrs that are about, you know, bad anatomy and bad drawing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I first started doing the Brokeback pose, I think it really was about that. And I do think, like, if you look at every superhero poster, I mean, it is just the cliche of the girl is always standing there in the Brokeback. She's always, like, with her butt to the camera, but she's lurking back saucily over her shoulder. And actually, if you look at, there's several Avengers posters, actually, though, where the Hulk's doing that, too. So, I mean, it is like a dynamic pose. It is a thing. But like you said, I mean, it's badly done. And I mean, there's just so many over-sexualized, ludicrously over-sexualized depictions of women in comics that it just seems, why not have fun making fun of them? And I mean, now I think it is kind of a joke because, you know, people send me old pulp covers where there's girls doing it, and, you know, there's dolls doing it, cats doing it, this, that, the other thing. So to me, it's just like a funny little meme at this point. But the one that really does crack me up, I guess, is the fighting Brokeback, you know, where they're fighting and they have this twisted torso. And, you know, Kate Beaton went to town on it, man. She did this whole thing of like, what would it look like from the other side, you know? And actually, when I did the fighting Brokeback, I was like, how is this even possible? And then, you know, Raphael Cannon, who's a comics artist, you know, if you ever want a guest in your show, try to get him. He knows everything about everything. Just help him. But he, you know, he's a fight coordinator. I don't even know what Raphael does, but I think he's in the CIA, okay? But he knows all about fighting. And he's like, oh, well, you know, actually, there's a punch called the Superman, and that's what it is. And you know, sometimes when you're doing this, you know, when you shift your weight, I'm like, oh no, he's right. So you can do that. All right. Well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole section in How to Draw Comics to Marvel where John Buscema is like, if you're going to do a cover, you want to see the front of both characters.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're fighting each other,
mm-hmm.
You don't always want to have them side by side. So you do have, you know, the
yeah, no, it's a dynamic. Of course, it's a dynamic twisting pose. But some people do go.
But no, there are extremes to it. And then again, it's a bad drawing.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a lot of bad drawing all over the place.
So, I mean, you know, it's just something I have fun with. But I think.
But initially it was you were making some sort of point, or were you?
I think when I first started doing it, it was just because there was this rash of it that was everywhere, and especially on superhero covers. It just became this thing because they all, you know,
at this point, superhero covers are sort of all the same.
Yeah. But, you know, the one that I really, and, you know, this is something I would only say on the podcast, but, you know, because
scoop,
they're wonderful. Well, no, but it's because they're wonderful sponsors and I love them all. But, you know, Dynamite with their covers, like, I'll be cleaning up my office and I'll come upon this cover of Lady Rawhide or Red Sonja with no pants on doing something ridiculous. And I'll put it right up on the top bar. You know, Nikki's always like, Heidi, why are you making fun? It's like, well, look at this cover. She hasn't got any pants on. Like, even Red Sonja had a loincloth, but suddenly it's gone. She just has a little chainmail thing hanging there. So, you know, I mean, artists have different ways of getting off on their drawings, I guess. So
I wonder how much of that, because I, as somebody that draws, there is a disconnect for me between a drawing and a human person.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess other people don't have that disconnect.
Well, somebody was just telling me the other day, and you know, my memory's so bad now, I better go search and find out who it was, because this was a juicy one. But I think it was a comment on the beat where he mentioned that he had been told by his editors women weren't sexy enough and he needed to put them in better, you know, more provocative poses and stuff. So, you know, it's not even a, you know, when it's an editorial mandate, and I think that's what I was picking up on, you know, is that there was more than just a bunch of people drawing things that they wanted to see.
It seemed it at the time, and then, you know, it keeps popping up, and then it's not always that pose.
Right.
Like, what? I don't understand. I don't understand what the fight is.
Yeah.
I guess at this point, it's not a fight.
It's just a running gag. It's a running gag, and it's having some fun pointing out bad drawings. So, you know, and then one time there was one guy who I did it, and it was such a bad drawing, and I won't even say who it is, because he posted in the comments. I was like, what the hell? You know, my house just flooded. All right, maybe it's not the best drawing, but come on. You know, because everybody was just teeing off on him, and I felt so bad, because he's a really nice guy, so I took it down. So, because it was, it was bad, though. It was a really bad drawing, but he admitted. He says, all right, maybe it wasn't the best, but, you know, come on, give me a break.
Everyone has an off day. Yeah. In theory, we're doing a page a day. That's cranking it out, in theory.
Right, right.
The last thing I want to cover is, at the end of any piece, there are comments.
Yes.
And in comments, there are trolls, and there are decent people, and there's something called the flame war. I don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
It's been around for years. I still don't understand it. Is that just people?
That's just when that's when you just get really head up on the internet. You know? It's like a tweet battle now, you know.
So I imagine you moderate your comments on some level.
Yeah. I mean, I especially when some kind of hot topic is on there. I mean, I look at them pretty constantly, you know. It'll be the one time, like now, you know, I'm not looking at I'm sure while I was on this podcast, somebody posted something horrible. But
do they immediately upload, or you get them first and you can approve?
No, I don't, because that would be, you know.
You'd be doing that all day.
Yeah, I'd be doing it all day. So, but I do moderate it, you know, and I ban people all the time, and I remove comments.
What is that criteria? Like, how do you separate, I believe this is another phrase you use somewhere. How do you make it more signal, less noise?
Well, I mean, even though people say I have the worst comments on the internet, I really don't.
The worst in terms of?
Well, I don't. In terms of, you know, it's not like
monster
like,
people or just
well,
dumb
I
people? Because I've seen some really dumb people in other places.
I mean, my comments are far from the worst. And I mean, I think there's one or two places that have really good comments. And I will stand by my comments. I mean, I think, unfortunately, my tolerance for the trolls is a little bit high. And I should dial it back a little bit and get rid of some people. There's a couple people on there who have been with me the whole way that I actually banned recently because they were derailing conversation.
Don't they just pop back up with a different name?
No, because they were real people. I mean, okay. I have some real trolls who do that are real, you know, I should be prosecuted trolls as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, they were real people. So they didn't, they not very savvy internet people, I guess. Or they just didn't want to or whatever. And then finally, I, you know, somehow or other the hammer slipped. So, I mean, I would rather once in a while have, and this happens all the time, where especially obituary posts where, you know, months later somebody will post on there. It's like, oh, you know, this is my grandpa and, you know, you should know that this and this. And I guess that happens, you know, once a month that something really great comments. So, I mean, is it worth all the shit for that once a month thing? Maybe not. I don't know. I've actually think it's gotten to the point now where even though I have some really great commenters, for the first time after the recent kerfuffles, I thought to myself, maybe I should use Facebook. And, you know, YouTube went to Google Plus comments only. So I don't know how that's worked out, but I need to investigate that a little bit more.
Facebook for to what end?
Well, you could put so that you could only comment if you're on.
In.
You have to sign
into
Facebook. And I do despise Facebook, so I probably would never do that. But there's other methods that you could use that are kind of similar. So maybe just a Google Plus profile. That means that only Torsten could post. But
yeah. I think we got everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure there's other stuff we could talk about.
Do you have one last question just to wrap it up, or do you do a wrap-up question?
I mean, I have one here. Kind of, it could be fairly open-ended. I don't know if it really even works, but it's basically, you know, you've been doing the internet game for a while. What would you want to see more of? What would you want to see less of?
Yeah. Well, I think what I want to see more of, I mean, I do know what I want to see more of, because I think we've had this absolute explosion of comics content. And, I mean, there's really still only me, Tom, Robot Six, the Comics Journal. I mean, people come and go a lot because there's no money in it. But I would love to see a new source that is really looking at all this stuff with some kind of passion and some degree of, you know...
Expertise,
but also chronicling this era. I mean, I do think a lot of things are going on in comics right now that are really, really, really exciting and very groundbreaking and very future forward. And, you know, things that change culture forever are happening in comics right now. I really honestly believe that. And or the comics will be connected to this somehow because it's all such a big melange now. So I would love to see. I mean, there was a big post. There was a big internet battle about a battle or a kerfuffle about this. Where it was on Twitter, so it's kind of hard to follow, but it was like, you know, what is the next Raw? What is the next Kramer Zurgut? Because we are ready for that. You know, Kramer Zurgut was this very influential indie anthology, came out 10 years ago, just in case anybody doesn't know. But, you know, Raw obviously is one of the most influential anthologies of all time. But it really is time. It's been 10 years. So is there going to be another print anthology? Or is Tumblr it? Is Tumblr Raw?
Probably.
Yeah.
Anthologies don't sell.
Right.
Unless it's Flight.
Right. Well, yeah. But I mean, it's also like there was a really interesting conversation, which I couldn't get anybody to do on the message board so that others could read it. It just came and went on Twitter. So, but I mean, this might be a pipe dream. Maybe it's not needed. Maybe this thing that I and a few other people want to see actually doesn't even need to exist anymore. So, you know, maybe we're being very like, oh my God, we've got to get a better buggy whip. You know, but I still think other people will want to have some kind of guide to it, you know. So that's what I want to see. I just want to see some of this lightning in a bottle, a lightning captured in a bottle, I guess.
You want to see an actual, like the actual content being put out, not like a Jamie Colville, but reporting on current. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Yeah.
He sort of keeps records of the past.
Yeah.
In a really good way.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Comics was a great zine that came out and really captured what was happening with the Kramer's generation. And the current generation seems to be moving too fast to be captured. So maybe it is just a Tumblr thing. Maybe
it's super fleeting.
Yeah, it is very fleeting. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I'll be curious to see it when it happens.
What do you want to see less of? Anything? anything you're, like, again.
That's Upworthy, man. Upworthy's my current peeve. So, I noticed on Facebook people, a lot of my friends are like, also, it's like, if I see anyone who posts this, you know, when this woman, you know, farts next to a flame, you won't believe what happens next, you know. I mean, it's the clickbait. So yeah, I mean, that's that, but that's fleeting. That'll change. Now people are gonna get sick of that pretty fast,
turn it to something else.
Yeah, exactly.
It always does.
I don't know what it'll be.
Thank you, Heidi. I appreciate you giving me the time.
All right, glad to be here.
Absolutely. And the beat goes on. Yes, the beat goes on. And the beat goes on.
So there you go, a talk with Heidi McDonald. How'd I do? What did I not cover that you wanted to hear covered? What did I cover that you were unaware of or were happy to learn about. You can let me know. You can go to stuffsaidshow.com if you're not there already, which is where I post show notes and links and all kinds of things, and you can leave a comment there. Last month's show with Scotty Young, Solomon left a great comment, and I left a really long, I didn't leave, I responded with a big, long reply. So you can see what happens when you comment. I reply. You can also email me, stuffsaid@gmail.com, and I will read that email. And I'll either reply an email, or maybe I'll read it and reply on the next show. It all depends. Depends on the message. Really, that's at my discretion. I think that's fair. You can also follow me on Twitter @StuffSaidShow, where I mention things and sometimes say something funny or interesting, or I don't know. So that's all the ways to do that. What else can I tell you? The show, not only is it at the website, it's also at iTunes. It's also at acmewaveprojector.com. If you go onto iTunes, you can leave a review. For this month, if you want, the review can say, "Can't be beat." How about that? You know, in reference to the fact that, yeah, Heidi McDonald's beat. Get it? So, yeah, if you want, rated 5 stars, put as your comment, "Can't be beat." That'll be fun. And the theme music provided by Craig Chin at rudeanagrams.com. And if you want to know more about me, go to hatterentertainment.com, HATTER entertainment.com. That wraps up episode 39. I never mention the numbers. I never talk about the numbers of the episodes, but this is episode 39, if you're keeping track. This is useless information. So based on that, that's about all the stuff I have left to say. I'll see you next time.